The death of a child is a tragedy, but even more horrific is when a child is killed by the hands of their own parent.
This is Australian True Crime. Come with us as we explore how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Author Cheryl Critchley and Dr. Helen McGrath are back this week to talk to us about filicide and the disturbing aspects of psychology that have led parents to kill their own children.
We better move on to filicide.
Filicide is the killing of your children.
Yeah.
I think sometimes these cases make me feel so angry. I just have to go for a long walk.
They're hard work, huh?
Because it's so hard to imagine killing your own children for the selfish reasons in most cases. I can't comprehend how anyone can do it. I mean, with Farquharson, for example, to actually go back and shut the door while the kids were trying to get out of the water and shut the door to make sure they couldn't get out.
Because I assume it's a break with reality, but then in those sorts of cases there seems to be so much planning and such a period of time that you think, no, that can't be a break. That's a lot of planning gone into
Absolutely. Well, Cheryl and I first began to work together as a result of a conversation we had. We began talking about Robert Farquharson, and she said, I can't stand that man. I can't understand or understand how he could do that. And I went, I feel the same way.
Mm.
And so we said, let's write about him and see if we can understand him and let him help other people. Because, I mean, he was so innocuous, such a nothing little man.
He was like a loser, really, wasn't he?
He was very much a loser. And I don't think there'd be very many women who'd look at him and say, wow, we need to have you in our life.
No.
And he'd been given so much. And,
he cultivated that image around the town. And what we found really interesting was even after he'd been found guilty, we went up there to Winchelsea and just went into the historical society and a few shops and things. And people still thought he was innocent and they didn't like Cindy. Oh, yeah, she was a bloody bitch.
Because how dare she leave him?
Yeah. And what he did, someone told us when we were there and we got a couple of other examples, he went to the extent of faking coughing fits before in front of people so that when he had his excuse saying, oh, I had a coughing fit, other people would go, oh, yeah, a couple of weeks ago. You know,
and that's
when
calculating
he was with me.
Isn't it?
That's what I mean about the planning, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
But people still thought he was innocent and more or less blamed the victim. It was all Cindy's fault and...
I think when you know a person, and I guess this is going to come up more and more in this conversation, when you know a bloke, you just cannot believe that he could possibly kill his kids. You can't believe it. Even if you don't particularly like the guy, you can't imagine that's possible.
It's incomprehensible to me. Yeah. I find them the most difficult to understand how people can murder their children, usually for revenge. And usually with the assumption that I own them, so therefore I can do what I like with them.
Well, we're having this conversation sort of in the shadow of the most recent case, which we can't talk about because we don't know any details about it, really. Four children and three adults who were found dead in Western Australia in Margaret River. It's just another case, though, of an entire family wiped out and a small community saying, but they were such a lovely family. We saw them 3 days ago. We worked with them. We knew them. We don't understand how this could happen.
Yeah, indeed. And I think there's more to be said about that story further down the track.
Okay.
I don't think at this stage that a lot is known. I think the police are being suddenly very quiet.
Yes, definitely.
Which makes us think that
there's more
may
to
not
the story,
be as it
think?
Seems. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, what about the horrific case? And I think about it every time I drive over the Westgate Bridge because I was thinking about it coming over with the big barriers, Arthur Freeman. And, I mean, that case absolutely shattered.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I recently saw a man on SBS. They did a special about witnesses and a man was talking about driving his car over the Westgate and seeing the car in front of him pull over into the service lane and seeing a man climb out and thinking to himself, he was very sweaty, big pool of sweat on the back of this man. And so the witness thought to himself, gee, that man's stressed. What's going on? And then he passed him and then in his rearview mirror, he saw this man climb out, pull a small child out of the car and throw her over the barrier. And that was his daughter, Darcy. And, of course, that man, that witness, is now traumatised, can't drive over the Westgate without, reliving it over and over again. It's just unbelievable that anyone could do that to this small girl. She was two or three or something.
And her little brother and her brothers were in the car
watching
it. Horrific.
Well, they just had a court hearing the day before, hadn't they, and it hadn't gone his way. So whatever had gone before that, would that have been the straw that broke the camel's back maybe with him
possibly,
for whatever reason?
But it hadn't gone badly in the sense that, you know, he didn't lose everything. It just wasn't 100% exactly what he wanted, but it actually had gone relatively well. So
you just can't imagine a more horrific way to do it either, can you?
No,
that it's throwing
it
in everybody's face to do that in such a public place. And interestingly, you know, he is rightly just absolutely slammed and condemned in the most serious possible way, whereas you contrast that with these other guys like Jeff Hunt and also Damien Little in South Australia, who killed his two sons and himself and drove off the pier into the sea. Those two guys were eulogised, but they actually killed more people than Arthur Freeman. And what they did was equally horrific, but the way it was done was different. So people see the cases differently, don't they?
I think from memory, in the case of Damien Little, I think his wife was sort of quite, I'm not going to say forgiving, but I think, you know, that their families were really like, oh, he was a great guy. He'd been suffering depression. The families are often leading the charge in this.
And he was suffering from depression, but he said quite categorically, but I'm not going to get treatment. I told him, it's not who I am. I'm not going for depression treatment.
But we need to change the way that we think about these cases, though, don't we, Helen? Because otherwise what Helen says as a psychologist is that guys read about this in the paper and, oh, look, you know, these guys were eulogised, and if I do the same thing, I'm going to be remembered as this great dad. All I've got to do is take myself with them and I'll be seen that way as well. So we do have to, like, condemn these people, because if they're eulogised, you can get this sort of copycat syndrome of other people considering it as well.
And in fact, there is quite clear evidence from researchers around the world that many of the men who do kill their own children or their own their whole family have in fact been trawling the internet looking for those cases to see how they'll be remembered. So it's like, it doesn't seem all that bad. They weren't all that harsh on that person. Maybe they were kind to me when I murdered my family. So that's really scary to think that the fact that the initial stuff wasn't condemning enough means that other people are more likely to do it.
Yeah, and you really feel for the families too, though, because I feel bad myself that we have got in this book that these were horrible people, because, as you say, Damien's wife was reasonably forgiving. So she'll probably read our book and be really upset by it, and I feel really bad about that. But you've got to think about the greater good and moving forward, trying to prevent these things happening again, understanding them and rightly condemning these guys, because they weren't psychotic. They made a conscious decision to kill their kids for whatever reason, whether it was to get back at someone or because they felt that they couldn't go on and they didn't like the idea of their kids coping without them. None of those reasons are ever a justification.
And we've actually identified what the researchers have concluded are the main motivations for these family annihilators. And, for example, with the Jeff Hunt case, where he killed his wife, his three children, and then himself in the dam, it appears that it was just an overriding sense of shame that he couldn't come to terms with as a result of some various things that had happened. Even a small thing which triggered it, although that wasn't the only factor, such as he'd been given a lot of bad reaction when he was previous weekend umpiring his child's football game with the under-12s, I think it was. And some of the audience watchers had started to boo him or yell. And it's believed that that was one of the factors which triggered that.
He called a point and some people thought it was a goal. So they said that he cheated.
Yeah. And then when his kid went to school on the Monday, they described other kids were horrible about his father and said, your father is a, and they used a word that rhymes with his surname, Hunt. And so from his point of view, it went with a couple of other things that had happened in the previous few years, few months, and triggered this incredible sense of shame that he couldn't recover from, but he didn't seek help for, and decided that the best thing to do was to take his children with him because they were his children, and they probably couldn't cope with the mum who was still recovering from her injury.
She had an acquired brain injury, didn't she? She was quite, you know, significantly
and
impacted.
And again, she was recovering quite well. Yeah. She was back working at a nurse for 2 or 3 days a week.
That triggered this sort of sense of sympathy for him that he'd been coping with his wife who had this brain injury. Do you remember?
Yeah, I do.
This idea that, oh, he'd been under so much pressure and...
But they had plenty of money. If he really couldn't cope, he could have left and they could have changed their lives in some way. But that sense of shame was just too hard, and maybe some guys like him just would think they'd be too embarrassed if their family broke up. So rather than do something like that, they'd rather kill them.
I'm developing a theory as I speak about the way we're raising men in our culture. Is it different to other cultures? And the rate at which our men kill their wives and ex-wives and ex-partners, and also this idea of killing our families. I mean,
Australian men?
Yeah, Australian men.
No, not of the good researchers coming from the UK. Ireland seems to have a particularly high number, and from the USA. Right. So, I don't think Australians are doing it more.
Okay.
I think we're just part of the general pattern that's about that.
So what happening. Is it? Again, is it resilience?
It's about coping with emotions, dealing with the fact that if you do feel like you're a failure, or if you do feel a sense of shame, or if your partner is going to leave you, being able to cope with it and having this sense of optimism, which is that I can do something about this to change my life. So it does come back in many ways to starting to teach kids resilience at an early age and how to handle their emotions, because your emotions are not necessarily fact. Your emotions are how you're perceiving facts.
What a great point. Your emotions aren't fact. They're how you're perceiving
feelings aren't facts and facts aren't feelings.
Yes.
Or something that kind of saying.
Point, yes.
But I often think about, you know, we've got social media, like 24-hour news cycle. It seems like the ability to recover from stuff, like you make a mistake, something happens, the ability to recover and sort of better yourself is kind of being eroded a bit by, you know, someone says something stupid on social media, right? I'm not talking about recent examples, but John Ronson wrote it in So You've Been Publicly Shamed, an amazing book. Feels like there's no wriggle room now to kind of, you know, be a dickhead or make a mistake and then, okay, you can recover. It's like you're always going to be remembered for that. And that concerns me, I think, of some of the, you know, stuff we up to as kids. I think, God, if it was now, I'd have no hope. But do you think that technology is making things harder? Not talking about people killing their families, but just in the general terms of, you know, being able to feel like you can safely make a mistake and then kind of move on from it.
And be consigned to history and nobody will ever know that you were at school at 14 and got caught with your friends.
You know, got caught smoking or, you know.
Increasing our shame levels.
Shame is a strong.
I think so. I tend to avoid it for those reasons. I'm always distrustful of what can happen if you things on you shouldn't. I think it's probably contributing. I think it's a danger. But we know that cyberbullying, for example, has got a very negative impact on the mindset of young people because they're very frightened of it. And we've had a couple of children suicide with it after being bullied. So I think it's not helping. I guess that's the best way to say it. And I guess if you're in the public eye, you sort of always have expected that. But even then, there was a lot more things that could be covered up. In previous days, because nobody posted it to somebody else or sent it to the media by, you know, some method or other.
Well, Michelle, I mean, you're, you know, pretty much in the public eye. You're on the project. How do you feel about, you know, sometimes when we say something and people just slam you back?
Yeah.
How do you cope with it? What are your feelings?
I try not to read it, but also I don't go out. I never go anywhere. So that helps. But I do hear stories from people about when they used to, you know, go to the Melbourne Cup or something 20 years ago, 25 years ago, famous people. It's just outrageous. And they could never do that anymore.
Yeah, no.
You know, absolutely. So I think, yes, it's very much easier to shame people now. And shame is such a strong emotion. And I don't think men in particular cope well with it. Would that
I
be
think
fair
you're
to
right.
say?
I would agree with
and
you.
And that when men are embarrassed, they get angry.
Yeah. Because they're meant to be tough and strong and never be doing anything to feel ashamed.
Yes.
Yes, it's a strange myth.
Yeah, it's a very difficult emotion for them. So what are can you talk us through the various ways in which they can kind of rationalise to themselves what they are doing? What makes them feel, you know, I guess there's part of it is my children won't cope without me.
That's part of it, yes.
Part of it is punishing the wife. I'll take this thing from her. This was the Farquharson idea, right?
Yeah. It's probably a combination of all of those bits and pieces. And when you get one or two of them, it tips it over into now I'm going to act. Because, Greg Hunt shame, my kids won't be able to cope without me. What did he say? That they won't be able to run the farm because they couldn't bear my wife having to tell them what to do.
And the older son had ADHD and he worried about whether he'd be able to cope.
ADHD is no big deal. It's just, you know, slightly annoying, something that needs to be supported, that's all.
Yeah.
All of that thinking, and again, if they were able to have the courage to go by themselves to a counsellor and talk that through, the counsellor could basically help them to respond and deal with it more rationally. Mm. But again, the very act for some men of going to talk to a counsellor is shameful.
You know, some positive has come out of that case though, and we've mentioned it in the book. I spoke to the Mayor, Councillor Roger Shermer, and he said there were a lot of things happening, activities, theatre groups and things that were being set up and boosted all around that area, encouraging guys to seek help and just meet each other, talk about all this sort of stuff.
Do you think that works? Do you think in a community where everyone is stunned by something like this, does that encourage the other men to seek help?
I think it would if they were prepared to talk about it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, sometimes when I know with my own patients, some of the men that I see who are having issues that they deal with have not told anybody that they're seeing a psychologist because that in itself is seen as something which other people wouldn't understand and think positively about, despite the fact that it makes a difference to them.
That was the entire premise of The Sopranos, remember?
Yes.
The idea of a man seeking help and desperately not wanting anyone to know.
No, because a real man doesn't need help.
Yes, it's so emasculine.
And there's that perception of just harden up, mate.
Yes.
You know, like...
Yeah, and he was the hardest man of all, but he couldn't let anyone know that he would ever ask anybody for help with his personal problems.
After the break, Helen and Cheryl talk more about filicide. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Helen and Cheryl discuss more of the social issues surrounding filicide.
So some good can come out of these cases, and you'd hope that there'd be a flow-on effect from that as well, that maybe someone will research what's going on in that area and how these programs have helped, and maybe they can, you know, introduce them in other areas as well.
How does it affect surviving family members how does all of it affect them, but certainly this eulogising of perpetrators?
It must be difficult for them, I think. I don't think I can even predict that. I would imagine that they might be slightly comforted in some ways, but not necessarily totally believing the what has been claimed. I mean, for example, it's quite obvious that in many cases, as we said, revenge for filicide, revenge is part of it because that's part of the picture. To have to live with that is horrible, and of course that's the motivation. I will now make my wife's life so miserable for the rest of her existence that she'll never wake up any morning okay. Because she knows that the children died because of her, not because of what I did, but because, you know, of her. She left me or whatever, which is completely fallacious.
Yes.
But at the same time, that's exactly how it happens.
That was definitely the attempt, the Farquharson attempt, wasn't it, to make
terrible, absolutely terrible,
feel that every day for the rest of her life, to make her feel that she had done that.
Yeah.
And going back to Damien and Melissa Little in South Australia, Damien killed himself and his kids when he drove them off the pier. Do you think for Melissa to be so sort of forgiving and to really include Damien always in the victims list, as she seems to do, do you think that's part of a coping mechanism for her?
I can only assume that that is the case, yes. And I would be thinking, is probably getting some kind of counselling support. Yeah. And I guess we all deal with things in different ways.
Yeah.
I would think that's possible.
I mean, I guess, I don't know what the status of their relationship was in that moment, but it seemed to be they were still married.
Yes, I think so.
I guess she has lost her husband, a man she loved.
Or somebody that she cared for either way. Yeah.
And who had been suffering depression and whom she had been trying to help and all of that stuff. I guess it's hard to just suddenly flip that narrative and make him a villain.
Murderer. And does she have to, though? Like, should she have to live the rest of her life hating what he did when that would make her life harder, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So you think you don't really blame them for being like that, do you?
Fudging the truth a little, yes.
And change the story of who he was for the preceding, however long they were together. I guess it's one of those things, isn't it? It's a complicated and nuanced conversation. Whereas to us, it seems very simple. To us, he's a man who killed his kids and therefore
There's no excuse. Yeah.
Yes, I guess the reality is that none of us knows exactly how it would feel or how it would respond.
Oh, no.
If we're not in that situation. So it's hard to judge, but at the same time, if we can prevent some of these things from happening, it'll mean that a lot of women won't have to try and deal with it.
So that's what compelled you to write about it?
Yes. Mm. We want to help other people. We want to help them to identify when they might be at risk. We want to help them to understand why certain situations occur, etc., and hopefully prevent more of those, of all of the kinds of murders that we describe in the book.
So what sort of tips, I don't want to use that, sounds like a very simple word to use, but what sort of things did you come up with? What sort of ideas did you come up with for people to keep an eye out for? What are we looking for in men who are becoming so, you know, emotionally compromised?
Yes. You're looking for withdrawal. You're looking for negative mood. And you're looking for not wanting to talk about it because that suggests that there's an issue that they're trying to deal with that they're not coping well with very effectively, but they feel too ashamed to talk to their wives about it. So you're looking for that if you're married to someone who's behaving like that. You'd be encouraging them to go and get some help, go and seek help.
Yeah, it brings us back to that old catch-22. You know, if they're refusing to seek help. Yeah. How do we, what
because
do we
it's
do
not it's not a male thing, despite the fact that it's actually an act of courage and strength, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
You know, for where I sit, the men who sought help are actually the strongest and more masculine are the men, whereas the ones that don't. I mean, I don't think, did Farquharson get help? I don't think so.
Not formally, I don't think. But some of them are also good at hiding it too, aren't they? So would the wife actually pick up on them behaving differently?
Well, maybe there's a warning in the book to the wives to keep an eye out for things like that. And if you see anything which is a little out of the ordinary or makes you think the person, your partner's becoming more withdrawn or something like that, keep an eye on things.
Also, unfortunately, sometimes the wives have given up by this stage, haven't they? Sometimes,
occasionally,
you
know,
the wives have left, we've broken up. Yeah. And, it's one of those things that we can't it's hard to be on the lookout for.
Farquharson had made that threat to his mate at the fish and chip shop.
Yes.
That, I'm going to get her back. But then people talk like that sometimes, don't they? And this poor guy, I've spoken to him. He didn't want to go on the record, but it's just destroyed his life because he was also treated really badly as a witness because he came forward with that later on. And you just think, is that something he should have taken anywhere or done anything with? You just don't know, do you?
None of us know what we'd do in that situation.
And what would the police do?
Yeah.
If he went to the police and said, oh, my mate just said he was going to do this, then the cops would be like, well, we've had that plenty of times and nothing's happened. So.
Well, they can't act really on a possibility.
No, and it wasn't.
But I suppose you can be on the alert then, can't you?
Yeah.
And I'm sure he was after that. He was probably taking more notice of things, but there wasn't any other major signs. So.
No. And when you're going through the family court, that could mean anything too.
Yeah.
You know, that wasn't really an overt threat of violence, I didn't think. If I'd heard that at the fish and chip shop.
Yeah, you don't know what to do.
Well, he basically said, what would you do, mate? And he said, I'd take away the thing she loved most. And he said, what? The kids, and he went, you wouldn't.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's more specific.
Yeah, it is. It's but I would have thought of custody.
You wouldn't believe it at the time, would you?
Yeah.
You wouldn't have thought he was capable of it.
I just always think such myself, an innocuous we just person. Never believe anyone will do anything like that. Every time, you know, I hear a story, a fresh news story, and I just think, who would ever believe that anyone would do that? No one would believe it.
Oh, when Sharon and I were in Winchelsea, we stopped by to look at the dam, and it was. It's actually, you know, for such a horrible thing to have happened, it was just like an ordinary, not very big dam. And we remember thinking, so many awful things happened here that affected the community. The whole community's been affected by it. And I don't think he'll ever get out of jail. I can't imagine there being any releasing him for any reasons at all. We do hear that he's not getting a good time in jail. Men who, or anyone who kill their children, don't get good times in jail.
No, because again, this reminds me of your man from before with his name Ian.
Jamison.
A lot of guys in there had such shit-ass childhoods, I think.
Well, it makes them vulnerable. So it's not an excuse, but it makes them a little bit more vulnerable to sets of circumstances.
Part of that equation.
Part of the equation. To some extent, we've always said that, you know, behaviour is not just an A leads to B, it's an A plus B plus C plus D might lead to E. And with Jamison, it's just so sad that the effect of his actions have had such negative impact on those who love the victims, you know.
And particularly I had a lady in here the other day for a different podcast who, I can't remember her name, but she's written a book. She went through the foster system and the system in the 80s, so long after him, and 90s. And so I was just thinking about all the things she told me that happened to her, and I'm thinking, is it any wonder he grew up so paranoid and it affected him so badly, you know, because it is like that. You can't trust anyone. People are taking things from you all the time. You can't keep anything.
Yeah.
And he was of the generation where there's no way you would have gone to a counsellor or
anything
like
that. No. You wouldn't have trusted them. Because in the system in those days, they were just as likely to take something from you, you know?
Yeah.
It's interesting that the other case of the paranoid personality disorder has simply sort of disappeared off the radar. That was the woman who was angry that her neighbour over the road, who was doing some fitness classes in her gym or spare room, was allowing the people to park in the street quite legally, and she wouldn't tell them to go park away so that they were annoying the person over the road. And you remember, what's her name?
Eva Whitecross.
And so she followed her down the street one day and just stabbed her to death with a knife.
Yes, but she
claimed mental impairment, remember, so we probably can't comment
on
that.
Rachel Blackwin stabbing,
Yeah, but I think she has succeeded in mental impairment. So
yeah, and look, there are some cases where you can still say the person had a personality disorder, but they had it to the point where they'd also become psychotic. It's unusual, but it can still happen. So it's quite possible that was the case. On the other hand, sometimes when you're claiming dissociation, it's not as clear. Like in the first book, we had Catherine Knight, who was the one who killed the husband, to kill the ex-boyfriend and then chopped him up and
She skinned him.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Now, from her point of view, it was clear that there was some degree of dissociation, mental impairment, which can happen. I mean, we've said in the book, all of us can have dissociation. Simply, you know, like when you're driving down the road and you've been travelling for 3 minutes, you have no recollection of where you've been or what you've seen, and you think, was I actually in the car driving?
Yeah.
And I still was. Yeah. So therefore, you know, I must have been mentally competent. But at the same time, your brain is not necessarily cooperating and recording information.
Yeah, but she wasn't mentally impaired, though. She got locked up, never to be released. She was the first woman in Australia get life without parole.
And her past partners had all said she was extremely violent and obsessive and
dingo puppy.
But they said explosive. When she loved you, she really loved you. When she hated you, she really hated you. And I remember that as a key point because that again tells us about some of her issues that she wasn't coping at all well.
Thank you for downloading Australian True Crime, and thank you to our team, which is one person, Bartholomew Heeran. If you enjoy the podcast, please take the time to leave us a nice review and 5 stars and to follow us on Facebook.